Urgently, she told the two warders who were healing her like hunting hounds, but she doesn't say why. Moiraine allowed herself a brief smile. As with servants, sisters often forgot, accepted, had ears. Sometimes the best way to learn was to keep silent and listen. As she was making her way back down along the drafty, spiraling corridor, thinking about what she had learned and trying to ignore the cold, Swan came running up behind her. There were no sisters to be seen, but still. "Another message," Swan explained, "to Aisha Ravaneos. She kept muttering something about urgent, making it a question. I'll wager it was the same as you carried to Corrine. What do you suppose Tamra wants with a gray and a green together?" The gray handled matters of mediation and justice, where it came from laws rather than swords, and Aisha was reputed to adhere to the strictest letter of the law, no matter her own feelings, whether pity or contempt, a trait she shared with Corrine. And both women had worn the shawl for a very long time, though that could be unimportant. Moiraine might not be so handy with puzzles as Swan, but this truly was like the game of houses. She looked around carefully, including a glance over her shoulder. A maid was trimming the wicks on a stand lamp farther along the hallway, and two liveried men, one atop a tall ladder, were doing something concerning one of the wall hangings. There still was not a sister in sight, but she lowered her voice anyway. "Tamra wants searchers to look for the boy child. Oh, this changes everything. I was wrong, Swan, and you were right." "Right and wrong about what? What makes you think she's recruiting these searchers? How could the woman be so deft with puzzles and not see the pattern here?" "What matter could be more urgent to Tamra right now than the boy child, Swan?" she said patiently. "Or more secret, so she dares not put the reason on paper. That secrecy means that she believes the Reds cannot be trusted. That is what you were right about. More than that, how many other sisters will at first want to deny that this child really is the one prophesied, particularly if he evades discovery until he is a grown man and already channeling? No, she means to use sisters she is sure of to search for him. Where I was wrong was in thinking he would be brought to the tower. That would only expose him to the Reds and others who might be untrustworthy. Once found, Tamra will send him into hiding. His education will be at the hands of her searchers, the women she trusts most." Swan clapped a hand atop her head. "I think my skull will explode," she muttered. "You built all that from two messages, and you don't even know what they said." "I know one thing they said and one they did not. It is simply a matter of seeing the patterns and fitting the pieces together, Swan. Really, you should be able to do it easily." "Oh? Elid gave me a blacksmith's puzzle last week. Said she was bored with it, but I think she couldn't solve it. Want to try your hand?"
"Thank you. No,"
Moiraine said politely, and after a quick look for lurking sisters, stuck her tongue out at the other woman. The next day, Tamra sent three more messages. The first went to Malin Arganya, the second to Valera Gorovny, a plump little brown who always wore a smile and seemed to be bustling even while standing still, and the third was to Ludis Danin, a bony yellow, whose long grim face was framed by tightly beaded Tarabonner braids that hung to her waist. None let slip a hint of the message's content, yet all three had worn the shawl well over 100 years, and all three shared that reputation for strict adherence to the law. Moiraine saw it as confirmation, and even Swan began to believe. Five seemed too few to undertake the search for the boy child. Day by day the names entered into their small notebooks filled more and more pages, yet Tamra sent no further messages, at least not by them. Aeldra Najaf was raised Keeper of the Chronicles to replace Gitara, and she might have carried them, or more likely sent them by a novice. For a time, Moiraine and Swan tried keeping an unobtrusive watch on the Ammerlin's study and her apartments, taking turns to peek around the edge of the doorway, but Tamra had a steady flow of visitors. Not constant, but steady. Sitters could be dismissed from consideration, since sitters rarely left the confines of the city while they held a chair in the hall of the tower, yet any of the others could have been searchers, or not. It was extremely frustrating for Moiraine. that itch on the shoulder blade, just where her fingers could not reach. Soon enough they gave up attempts to spy. For one thing, there seemed no point. For another, with only one copying, recording the names went much too slowly. And Aeldra, returning to the Ammerlin's study, caught Moiraine lurking in the doorway. White hair was the sole similarity between Aeldra and Gitara, and Aeldra's was straight and cut as short as Corrine's. The new keeper was lean, her coppery skin turned to leather from long exposure to sun and wind, yet assuredly no one had ever called her a beauty, with her narrow jaw and sharp nose. For jewelry she wore the great serpent ring alone. Her dress was of blue wool, finely woven but simply cut, and the deep blue stole on her shoulders was no more than 2 fingers wide. A very different woman from Gitara. "What are you looking at, child?" she asked gently. "Just the sisters going in and out of the Ammerlin's study, Aes Sedai," Moiraine replied. "Every word true." Aeldra smiled. "Dreaming of the shawl? Perhaps your time would be better spent in study and practice." "We find time for both, Aes Sedai, and this work occupies my mind otherwise." "Also true. The search for the boy-child occupied every scrap of her mind, not given to thoughts she would rather not have." A faint frown creasing her forehead, Aeldra laid a hand on Moiraine's cheek, almost as if checking for fever. "Do those other dreams still trouble you? Some of the Browns know a great deal about herbs. I'm sure one will give you something to help you sleep if you need it." "Varin Sedai already has." The concoction had had a foul taste, but it did help her sleep. A pity it did not help her forget the nightmares that came when she did. "The dreams are not so bad now." Sometimes there was no way to use evasion. "Good, then." Aeldra's smile returned, but she shook a mildly reproving finger under Moiraine's nose. "Nevertheless, daydreaming in doorways is not proper for one of the accepted child. If I see it again, I will have to take notice. You understand me?"
"Yes, Aes Sedai."
There would be no more spying. Moiraine began to think she would scream from that cursed itch. Chapter 8. Shreds of Serenity. There was no evading their private lessons with the sisters either. Not that Moiraine wanted to, or Swan either, but long hours sitting and writing left them surprisingly tired, and also left only the evenings free after supper. The accepted, who still rode out every day at sunrise, did the same, though many grumbled at it, when there were no Aes Sedai around to overhear. At least, they took lessons when lessons were offered. Some sisters refused, saying they would teach accepted again when they no longer had to give novice classes that should have been taught by accepted. All too many Aes Sedai disliked the situation. Gossip said that petitions had been presented to the Ammerlin requesting a return to normal routines, but if so, Tamra rejected them. The sisters' faces remained masks of serenity, yet frequently the eyes of even the mildest flashed with a fire that made novices squeak, and accepted step very gingerly. In the depths of winter's cold, the tower seemed feverish. Swan never spoke of her own experiences, but Moiraine quickly realized that she herself attracted particularly heated looks from nearly every Aes Sedai she encountered, and she understood why. Unlike the rest, she and Swan could have given novice classes and taken their own lessons at a more reasonable hour. A few sisters who taught others at night pronounced themselves busy when either of them tried to schedule a lesson. In some ways, Aes Sedai could be as petty as anyone else, though that was something no accepted dared say aloud. Moiraine hoped these small enmities would fade soon. Paltry irritations sometimes had a way of festering into lifelong antagonisms. What could she do, though? Apologize humbly to those who seemed most angry, begging their indulgence, and hope. She would not give up the lists. Not all sisters were so reluctant. Corrine met with her to discuss the relatively few facts known to historians of Arthur Hawkwing's empire. Malin tested her on the ancient writer Willem of Manaches and his influence on the Saldaean philosopher Shivina Kayenzi, and Aisha questioned her closely on the differences in the structure of law in Shinar and Amadisia. That was the sort of lesson she took now. What they could teach her of the power, what she could learn of it, not always the same, had been imparted months past. Had she dared, she would have asked why they were still in the tower. Why were they not out hunting down the names on the list? Why? And yet she knew the answer. What had to be the answer? Nothing else fit. But they felt no urgency. Taking the boy from his mother straight away would be cruel. Maybe they thought they had years to find him, but if that was the case, they had not even seen the list yet, with so many entries lacking as much as a home village. Maybe they were waiting for its completion. She hoped there were other searchers, because Swan reported Valera and Ludice were still in the tower. No urgency. Moiraine burned with it. Rumor said the fighting continued, many leagues southeast, but only in skirmishes, though some were said to be fierce. Apparently no one among the commanders of the coalition army wanted to press too hard on dangerous foes, who were, after all, in retreat. That last was certain, at least, reported by Aes Sedai. Rumor said many of the Murandians and Daltarans had already packed up and headed south for home, that the Amadisians and Gil'danin planned on following soon. Rumor added that word had come of troubles along the Blight, and the Borderlanders would soon ride north. Aes Sedai, it seemed, paid no heed to rumors. She tried bringing the tales up with them, but... Rumor is irrational and has no place here, child, Malin told her firmly, her gaze serene above the teacup balanced on her fingertips. Now, when Shevina said that reality is illusion, where did she gain insight from Willem, and what was her own? If you want to talk of rumors, make them rumors of Hawkwing, Corrine said, voice sharp. She always toyed with one of her knives while teaching, using it for a pointer. Tonight it was a poor man's belt knife, so old that the wooden handle was cracked and warped. The light knows half of what we have of him is rumor. Aisha sighed and pointed a stout finger, her soft brown eyes suddenly quite hard. A plain-faced woman who could have passed for a farmer's wife, she wore a wealth of jewelry, earrings with large fire-drops, long necklaces of both emeralds and rubies, but only the golden great serpent for a finger ring. If you cannot keep your mind on the matter at hand, perhaps a visit to Marian is in order. Yes, I thought you'd say that. No, making them see the urgency was just impossible. All she could do was wait, and practice not grinding her teeth. Light, let her test soon. With the shawl on her shoulders, she would be out of the tower and searching for the boy like an arrow leaving the bow. Soon, but not before she had all of the names. Oh, it was such a quandary. The accepted's quarters seethed with rumors more than usual, though not about who had had a spat with whom or which green was said to be behaving scandalously with a warder. These tales were gotten from guardsmen, from soldiers, from men and women in the camps, about the fighting, about men who had died heroically, and those who had been heroes and still lived. Those were particularly talked over. Such a one might have the qualities of a warder, a subject much discussed by accepted, save the few who already knew they wanted the red. There were tales of camps breaking, though no one knew whether they were moving east after the army or returning home, and tales of small groups remaining behind to make sure that women's names were entered for the tower's bounty. At least that reduced the chances that the right woman would slip away unknown. But if she was already entered and already gone, would she be among those who would be easily found? Moiraine could have screamed from frustration. Elid Abarame had a story from an Aes Sedai, though she insisted it was no rumor. I heard Adalorna tell Shemaean, Elid said with a smile. Elid always smiled when she saw herself in a mirror, and when she smiled, she always seemed to be looking into one. A gusting evening breeze in the well rippled the waves of golden hair framing her perfect face. Her eyes were like large sapphires, her skin like rich cream. The only fault in her appearance that Moiraine could see was an overabundance of bosom, and she was very tall, nearly as tall as most men. Men smiled at Elid when they did not leer. Novices mooned after her, and too many fools among the accepted envied her. Adalorna said Gitara had a foretelling that Tarman Gaiden will come during the lifetimes of sisters now breathing. I can't wait. I intend to choose green, you know. Every accepted knew that. I mean to have 6 warders when I ride to the last battle.
Every accepted knew that, too. Elid was always telling you what she intended to do. She almost always did it, too. That hardly seemed fair.
So?
Warain said softly, when Elid had joined the others, streaming off to supper. Getara did have other foretellings. At least one, and if one, then perhaps more.
Swan frowned.
We already know the last battle is coming. She fell silent while Katarina and Serene passed, talking wearily of whether they were too tired to eat, then went on once they were beyond earshot.
What does it matter if Getara had a dozen foretellings or 100?
Swan, did you never wonder how Tamra could be certain this is the time? That the boy will be born now?
I would say it is very likely that at least one of those other foretellings spoke of him. Something that, put with what we heard her say, told Tamra that now is the time.
It was Moiraine's turn to frown in thought. Do you know how the foretelling was with Getara? It took different women in different ways, including how they gave voice to a foretelling. The way she spoke, he could have been being born at that instant. Maybe the shock of that was what killed her.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, Swan said glumly, then gave herself a shake.
Light, let's go eat. You still need practice. They had resumed the practicing, too, at least at night, and Mirel continued to help when she was not so tired that she went straight to her bed after supper, or sometimes before. Enough of the accepted did one or the other that the galleries were still and silent long before the lamps were extinguished. The practice went poorly for Moiraine, especially in the beginning. The very first night Elida entered her room while she was suffering Swan and Mirel's torments on her flowered rug. The fire had been built as high as the small hearth would accept, but the best that could be said was that the blaze took the edge off the chill. At least it was not freezing.
I'm glad to see you're not taking the excuse of your work to avoid practice, the Red Sister said. Her tone said she was surprised to see it, and contempt wrapped the word work. Once again her dress was pure red, and she wore her fringed shawl as though on appointed duties. Moving to a corner facing Moiraine, she folded her arms beneath her breasts.
Continue. I wish to observe.
There was nothing for it but to obey.
Perhaps spurred by Elida's presence, Swan and Mirel did their very best, which meant their very worst for startling slaps and pinches, sudden bangs beside Moiraine's ear, and switch-like blows across her legs, always just when she needed her concentration most. She tried not to look at Elida, but the sister stood where she could not avoid seeing her. Elida's judgmental gaze made her nervous, yet maybe it inspired her as well, or drove her. Focusing herself, concentrating with all she had, she managed to complete 61 weaves before the 62nd collapsed in a tangle of earth, air, water, and spirit that left her skin clammy until she let it dissipate. Not a wonderful performance, but neither was it so terrible. She had come close to completing all 100 on numerous occasions, but she had actually done it only twice, once by the skin of her teeth.
Pitiful. Elida said, cold as ice. You'll never pass like that.
And I want you to pass, child. You will pass, or I'll make you take off your skin and dance in your bones before you're sent away. You two are pitiful friends, if that's how you help her. We knew how to practice when I was accepted.
Directing Swan and Mirel to the corner where she had been standing, she took their place at the table.
This will show you how it is done properly. Again, child.
Wetting her lips, Moiraine turned her back. Mirel gave her an encouraging smile, and Swan nodded confidently, but she could see their worry. What would Elida do? She began. As soon as she embraced the power, flashes of light began streaking across her line of vision, leaving black and silver flecks dancing in her eyes. Bangs and piercing whistles made her ears ring. Blows, as from hard-swung straps or switches, struck her one after another. It was all continuous, with no let-up until she completed a weave, and then only a short pause until she began to weave again. And all the while Elida harangued her in a cold, matter-of-fact tone.
Faster, child. You must weave faster. The weave must almost leap into being complete. Faster, faster. Clutching at Serenity with her fingernails, Moiraine reached only the 12th weave before her concentration broke completely. The weave not only collapsed, she lost Sidar entirely. Blinking, she tried to clear the dancing flecks from her sight, and more successfully to blink back tears. Pain covered her from shoulders to ankles, bruises aching, welts throbbing, stinging from sweat. A constant chime was sounding in her ears.
"Thank you, Aes Sedai," Swan said quickly. "We see what we must do now."
Mirel's hands were clutching her skirts and fists. Her face was ashen, her eyes wide with horror.
"Again," Elida said.
It took everything Moiraine had in her to make herself turn her back once more. The only difference was that she finished just 9 weaves this time.
"Again," Elida said.
On the 3rd try, she completed 6 weaves and only 3 on the 4th. Sweat rolled down her face. After a while, the flashing lights and ear-piercing whistles hardly seemed more than annoyances. Only the incessant beating mattered. Only the endless beating and the endless pain. On the 5th attempt, she fell to her knees, weeping beneath the first shower of blows. The pummeling ceased instantly, but huddling in on herself, she sobbed as though she would never stop. Oh, light! She had never hurt like this before. Never. She was not even aware of Swan kneeling beside her until the other woman said gently, "Can you stand, Moiraine?" Raising her head from the rug, she stared up at Swan's face, full of concern. With an effort she had not thought in her, she managed to master her weeping, barely, then nodded and began to push herself up laboriously. Bruised muscles did not want to lift her. Every movement scrubbed her shift against the sweat-stung welts, clothing her in burning agony.
"She will live," Elida said dryly. "A little pain tonight will drive the lesson home. You must be fast. I will come back in the morning to heal her. And you too, Swan. Help her to the bed and begin."
Swan's face paled, but when an Aes Sedai commanded... Moiraine did not want to watch, yet Swan had been forced to, so she held her eyes open by force of will. It made her want to begin weeping all over again. Often when they practiced, Swan managed to complete every last weave despite anything Moiraine could do. She never failed less than 2/3 of the way through. Tonight, under Elida's strict tutelage, she managed 20 the first time. The second it was 17, and 14 on the 3rd. Her face was drained of color and slick with sweat. Her breath came raggedly, but she had not shed a tear. And when a weave failed, she started from the beginning again without so much as a moment's pause. On the 4th try, she finished 12, and 12 on the 5th, the 6th. Doggedly, she began to weave once more.
"That's enough for tonight," Elida said.
Not one drop of pity touched her voice. Slowly, painfully, Swan turned, the light of Sidar vanishing. Her face was absolutely devoid of expression. Elida went on calmly, adjusting the shawl on her shoulders.
"Even if you managed to finish as you are, you would still fail. There isn't a shred of serenity in you."
She fixed first Swan and then Moiraine with a stern eye.
"Remember, you must be serene, whatever is done to you. And you must be fast. If you are slow, you will fail as surely as if you fall to panic or fear. Tomorrow night we will see if you can do better."
Swan waited until the door closed behind the Aes Sedai, then threw back her head.
"Oh, light!"
she wailed, falling to her knees with a thud, and the tears she had held back came in torrents. Moiraine bounded from the bed. Well, she tried to bound. It was actually more of a pained hobble, and Mirel reached Swan first. The 3 of them knelt there, holding one another and weeping, Mirel as hard as she or Swan. Finally, Mirel pushed back, sniffing and wiping tears from her cheeks with her fingers. "Wait here," she said, as if they were in condition to go anywhere, and darted from the room. Soon she returned with a red glazed jar the size of her 2 fists, and also Shiriam and Elid to help get Swan and Moiraine undressed and apply the ointment in the jar.
"This is wrong,"
Elid said fiercely once the pair of them were naked and she was opening the jar, all the gasping over their welts and bruises finished. Shiryam and Mirel nodded quick agreement.
The law forbids using the power to discipline an initiate.
Oh, Swan growled. And how often have you had your ear flicked with the power by a sister or gotten a stripe across your bottom?
A gasp broke from her mouth.
There's no need to rub that clear to the bone, is there?
I'm sorry, Elid said in contrite tones. I'll try to be easier.
Vanity was a powerful fault, but that was her only real fault. Her only one. It was very hard to like Elid.
You two should report this. We could all go to Marian.
No,
Moiraine breathed hoarsely. Going on, the salve stung worse than the welts. It was better after. A little better.
I think Elida really is trying to help us. She said she wants us to pass.
Swan stared at her as though she had sprouted feathers.
I don't recall hearing her say that. Myself, I think she's trying to make us fail.
Besides, Moiraine added, whoever heard,
Shiryam muttered an apology, but the ointment still stung.
Whoever heard of an accepted complaining without paying for it?
That brought three nods, grudgingly given, yet they nodded.
Novices who complained received a gentle, if firm, explanation of why matters were how they were. Accepted were expected to know better. They were required to learn endurance every bit as much as history or the One Power.
Maybe she'll decide to leave you alone, Shiryam said,
but she did not sound as if she believed it would happen.
When they finally departed, Mirel left the jar of ointment behind. Only Varin's vile-tasting concoction let them sleep, huddled beneath the blankets in Moiraine's narrow bed, and it was the grim reminder of that jar sitting on the mantel that warred with sleep as much as their welts and bruises.
Elida was as good as her word, appearing before daybreak to use healing on them, and it was used, not offered. She merely cupped their heads between her hands and wove without asking. When the intricate weave of spirit, air, and water touched her, Moiraine gasped and convulsed. For a moment it felt as though she were totally immersed in icy water, but when the weave vanished, her yellowing bruises were gone. Unfortunately, Elida supplied a new crop that night and another on the following. Moiraine lasted through 7 attempts and then 10 before pain and tears overwhelmed her. Swan made 10 on the second night and 12 on the third. And Swan never wept until Elida was gone. Not one tear. Shiryam, Mirel, and Elid must have kept watch, for each night after Elida left they appeared to offer commiseration while undressing Swan and her and spreading the salve on their injuries. Elid even tried telling jokes, but no one felt like laughing. Moiraine began to wonder whether the jar held enough ointment to last. Had she misheard? Could Swan be right, that Elida wanted them to fail? A cold terror settled in her belly, a leaden lump of ice. She was afraid that the next time she would beg Elida to stop. But Elida would not. She was certain of that, and it made her want to cry. On the morning after Elida's third visit, though, it was Marian who woke them in Swan's bed and offered healing. "She will not trouble you in this manner again," the motherly eyes Sedai told them once their bruises were gone.
"How did you find out?" Moiraine asked, hurriedly pulling her shift over her head.
With them sleeping like the dead under the influence of Varin's mixture, the fire had burned down to ashes in the night, and the air in the room was cold, if not quite so cold as it had been only days earlier, but the floor was little warmer. She snatched up her stockings from where they had been left, draped over a chairback.
"I have my ways, as you should know," Marian replied mysteriously.
Moiraine suspected Mirel or Shiryam or Elid, if not all three, but Marian was Aes Sedai. Never a straight answer when mystery would do, and perhaps do better. In any case, she very nearly earned herself an imposed penance, and I informed her that I'd ask the Amarlin for mortification of the flesh, and I reminded her that what I must deal to sisters is harsher than what I give novices or accepted. She was convinced.
"Why shouldn't she get a penance for what she did to us?" Swan asked, reaching behind herself to do up the buttons on her dress.
The mistress of novices raised an eyebrow at her tone, which came very close to demanding. But perhaps she believed they deserved a little leeway after Elida.
Had she used Sidar to punish or coerce you, I'd have seen her strapped to the triangle for birching. Yet what she did broke no law.
Marian's eyes twinkled suddenly, and her lips curved in a small smile.
Perhaps I shouldn't tell you, but I will. Her penance would have been for helping you cheat in the test for the shawl. All that saved her was the question of whether it actually was cheating. I trust you will accept her gift in the spirit it was given. After all, she paid a price in humiliation for giving it when I confronted her.
Believe me, Aes Sedai, I will, Swan said flatly. What she meant was plain. Marian sighed and shook her head, but said nothing more. The icy lump that had melted from Moiraine's middle when she learned there would be no further lessons from Elida returned twice as large. She had almost helped them cheat. Could she have given them a foretaste of the actual test for the shawl? Light. If the test meant being beaten the whole way, oh, Light, how could she possibly pass? But whatever comprised the test, every woman who wore the shawl had undergone it and succeeded. She would as well. Somehow she would. She pushed Mirel and Swan to be harder on her, but though they sometimes made her weep, they refused to do what Elida had done. Even so, again and again she failed to complete all 100 weaves. That lump of ice grew a little larger every day. They did not see Elida again for 2 days. And then it was on their way to dinner at midday. The Red Sister stopped beside a tall stand lamp at the sight of them, speaking not a word as they curtsied. Still silent, she turned to watch as they passed her. Her face was a severe mask of serenity, but her eyes burned. Her gaze should have scorched the wool of their dresses. Moiraine's heart sank. Clearly Elida thought they had gone to the Mistress of Novices themselves. And she had paid a price in humiliation, according to Marian. Moiraine could think of several ways that the threat of a penance could be used to make Elida give way, and every one of them would have wrung the sister with humiliation. The only question was, how hard had Marian wrung? Very hard, likely. She did speak of the novices and accepted as being hers. Oh, this was no small enmity that might fester over time. What was in Elida's eyes was full-blown animosity. They had acquired an enemy for life. When she told Swan as much, and her reasoning, the taller woman grunted sourly.
Well, I never wanted to be her friend, did I? I'll tell you, once I gain the shawl, if she ever tries to harm me again, I'll make her pay.
Oh, Swan, Moiraine laughed. I said, Dai, do not go about harming one another. But her friend would not be assuaged. 1 week to the day after Gitara made her foretelling, the weather warmed suddenly. The sun rose in a cloudless sky on what seemed like a cool spring day, and before sunset most of the snow had melted. All of it was gone around Dragon Mount, except on the very peak. The ground around the mountain had its own warmth, and snow always melted there first. The limit had been set. It was a boy born within those 10 days that they sought. 2 days later, the number who met the criteria began to dwindle sharply, and near a week on, 5 days had passed without another name being added to their small books. They could only hope that no more were found, though. 9 days after the thaw, in the dim light before dawn, Marian appeared on the gallery as Swan and Moiraine were leaving for breakfast. She was wearing her shawl.
Moiraine Damodred, she said formally, you are summoned to be tested for the shawl of an Aes Sedai. The light keep you whole and see you safe.
Chapter 9 It Begins.
Marian barely allowed time for a quick hug from Swan before leading Moiraine away, and with every step the lump of ice in Moiraine's middle grew. She was not ready. In all of her practices she had managed to complete all of the weaves only twice, and never under anything approaching the pressure Elida had put on her. She was going to fail and be put out of the tower. She was going to fail. Those words throbbed in her head, a drumbeat marking the walk to the headsman's axe. She was going to fail. As she followed Marian down a narrow staircase that spiraled deep into the bedrock beneath the tower, a thought occurred to her. If she failed, she would still be able to channel, at least so long as she remained circumspect. The tower frowned on ostentation in the women who were sent away, and when the tower frowned on something, only fools failed to take heed. The sisters said those sent away all but gave up touching Sidar, for fear of overstepping the tower's strictures inadvertently. But giving up that rapture was beyond her comprehension. She knew she never would, whatever happened. Another thought, seemingly unconnected. If she failed, she would still be Moiraine Damodred, scion of a powerful if disreputable house. Her estates would no doubt need years to recover from the ravages of the Aiel, but surely could still supply an adequate income. A third thought, and it all came together so obvious that clearly she had been thinking of it all along on some deeper level. She still had her book, with its hundreds of names, in her belt pouch. Even if she failed, she could take up the search for the boy. That carried dangers, of course. The tower more than merely disliked outsiders meddling in its affairs, and she would be an outsider then. Rulers had learned bitter regret for interfering where the tower planned. How much worse for a young exile, however powerful her house. No matter. What would be, would be. "The wheel weaves as the wheel wills," she murmured, earning a sharp look from Marian. The ritual was far from complex, but it must be adhered to. That she had forgotten that once below ground she must be silent until addressed said little for her chances in the actual test. It was very odd. She wanted to be Aes Sedai more than she wanted life, yet the knowledge that she could take up the search, whatever happened here, the knowledge that she would, quieted that drumbeat in her head. It even made the frozen lump dwindle. A little. One way or another, in a few days she would begin her own search. Light let it be as Aes Sedai. The lofty passages Marian led her along, carved through the rock of the island, as wide as any in the tower, were lit by lamps in iron brackets high on the pale walls, though many crossing corridors lay shrouded in darkness, or with only widely spaced lamps, making small lonely pools of light. The smooth stone floor was free of any speck of dust. The way had been prepared for them. The air was cool and dry, and beyond the faint scuff of their slippers, silent. Except for storerooms on the highest levels, these basements were seldom used, and everything was plain and unadorned. Dark wooden doors lined the corridors, all shut, and as they went deeper, securely locked. Many things were kept down here, safe from prying eyes. What was done down here was never for outside eyes either. On the very lowest level, Marian stopped before paired doors larger than any they had passed, as tall and wide as fortress gates, but polished to glistening and lacking iron straps. The Aes Sedai channeled, and flows of air swung the doors open silently on well-oiled hinges. Taking a deep breath, Moiraine followed her into a large, round, domed chamber ringed by stand lamps. Their light, reflected from the polished white stone walls, dazzled after the comparative dimness of the passages. Blinking, her eyes went immediately to the object centered beneath the dome, a great oval ring, narrow at top and bottom, its rounded rim little thicker than her arm. Well above a span in height, and perhaps a pace across at its widest, it glittered in the lamplight, now silver, now gold or green or blue, or swirls of all, never the same for more than a moment, and, a seeming impossibility, it stood unsupported. That was a Turang Real, a device made to use the One Power in the long-ago Age of Legends. Within it she would be tested. She would not fail. She would not. "Attend," Marian said formally. The other Aes Sedai already in the chamber, one from each Aja, came to stand in a ring around them, fringed shawls draped on their shoulders. One was Elida, and Moiraine's heart fluttered uneasily.
"You come in ignorance, Moiraine Domadred. How would you depart?"
Light! Why had Elida been allowed to be part of this? She wanted desperately to ask, but the words were prescribed. She was surprised to hear her voice come out steady. "In knowledge of myself."
"For what reason have you been summoned here?" Marian intoned.
"To be tried." Calm was all important, but though her voice sounded it, within was another matter. She could not shake Elida from her thoughts.
"For what reason should you be tried?"
"So that I may learn whether I am worthy." All of the sisters would try to make her fail. That was the test, after all. But Elida might try the hardest. Oh, Light, what could she do?
"For what would you be found worthy?"
"To wear the shawl."
And with that, she began to disrobe. According to ancient custom, she must test clad in the light, symbolizing that she trusted to the light's protection alone. As she undid her belt, she suddenly remembered the small book in her pouch. If that were discovered! But to falter now was to fail. She laid belt and pouch on the floor beside her feet and reached behind her back to work at her buttons. "Therefore I will instruct you," Marian went on. "You will see this sign upon the ground." She channeled and her finger drew a six-pointed star in the air, two overlapping triangles written for an instant in fire. Moiraine felt one of the sisters behind her embrace Sidar, and a weave touched the back of her head. "Remember what must be remembered," the sister murmured. It was Anaya, the blue. But this was not part of what she had been taught. What did it mean? She made her fingers march steadily along the buttons down her back. It had begun, and she must proceed in utter calm. "When you see that sign, you will go to it immediately, at a steady pace, neither hurrying nor hanging back, and only then may you embrace the power. The weaving required must begin immediately, and you may not leave that sign until it is completed."
"Remember what must be remembered," Anaya murmured.
"When the weave is complete," Marian said, "you will see that sign again, marking the way you must go, again at a steady pace, without hesitation."
"Remember what must be remembered."
100 times you will weave, in the order you have been given, and in perfect composure."
"Remember what must be remembered," Anaya murmured for a final time, and Moiraine felt the weaving settle into her, much as healing did.
All of the sisters, save Marian, moved away and formed a circle around the Turang Real. Kneeling on the stone floor, each embraced Sidar. Surrounded by the light of the power, they channeled, and the color shifting of the oval ring increased in speed until it flashed like a kaleidoscope attached to a mill wheel. All of the 5 powers they wove, in a complexity nearly as great as anything required in the test, every sister concentrating on her task.
No. Not true. Not completely.
Elida glanced away, and her gaze was stern and heated when it touched Moiraine. A red-hot awl fit to bore into her skull. She wanted to wet her lips, yet perfect composure meant exactly that. Protection of the light or no, removing her clothes in front of so many was not easy, but most of the sisters were concentrating on the Turang Real. Only Marianne was watching her now, watching for hesitation, for a break in her outward serenity. It was begun, and a break now brought failure. Yet it was just outward calm, a mask of smooth features that carried no deeper than her skin. Continuing to undress, she carefully folded each garment and placed it in a neat pile atop her belt and pouch. That should do. All of the sisters save Marian would be occupied until her test was done. At least she thought they would. And she doubted the mistress of novices would rummage through her clothing. In any case, there was nothing else to do now. Slipping off her great serpent ring, last of all, and laying the circlet of gold atop the rest brought a pang. Since winning that, she had worn it even when bathing. Her heart was racing, thudding so hard she was certain Marian must be able to hear. Oh, light, Elida. She would have to be very wary. The woman knew how to break her. She must watch and be ready. After that, she could only stand and wait. Her skin quickly pebbled with goose flesh in the cool air, and she wanted to shift her bare feet on the stone floor, which was more than cool. Perfect composure. She stood still, back straight, hands at her sides, and breathed evenly. Perfect composure. Light, help her. She refused to fail just because of Elida. She refused. But that lump of ice in her belly spread its chill along her bones. She let none of it show. A perfect mask of composure. The air in the opening of the ring suddenly turned to a sheet of white. It seemed somehow whiter than the wool of her skirts, whiter than snow or the finest paper, yet rather than reflect the stand lamps, it seemed to absorb some of their light, making the chamber grow dim. And then the tall oval ring began to revolve slowly on its base, without the slightest sound of stone grating against whatever it was made of. No one spoke. They did not need to. She knew what must be done. Unwavering, at least on the outside, she walked toward the turning ring at a steady pace, neither hurrying nor hanging back. She would pass whatever Elida did. She would. She stepped into the whiteness and through and wondered where in the light she was and how she had come there. She was standing in a plain stone corridor lined with stand lamps, and the only door at the far end stood open on sunlight. In fact, the only way out. Behind her was a smooth wall. Very strange. She was certain she had never seen this place before. And why was she there? Unclothed! Only the certainty that she must display absolute calm kept her from covering herself with her hands. Anyone might walk in through that far door at any moment, after all. Suddenly she noticed a dress lying on a narrow table halfway down the hall. She was positive neither table nor dress had been there a moment earlier, but things did not suddenly appear from thin air. She thought she was certain of that. Fighting not to hurry, she walked to the table and found a full set of garments. The slippers were embroidered black velvet, the white shift and stockings of the finest silk, the dress of only slightly heavier material, in a dark shimmering green, well cut and meticulously sewn. Bars of red, green, and white, each 2 inches tall, made a narrow line of color down the front of the dress from the high neck to below knee level. How could a dress with her own house colors be here? She could not recall the last time she had worn a dress in that style, which was very odd, for surely it had passed out of fashion no more than a year or two ago. Her memory seemed full of holes, chasms. Still, once she was clothed again, looking over her shoulder to do up the tiny mother-of-pearl buttons by her reflection in the stand mirror. Where had that come from? No, best not to worry over what seemed beyond explanation. The garments fit as though her own seamstress had measured her. Once she was dressed, she began to feel every inch the Lady Moiraine Domodred. Only having her hair arranged in elaborate coils on the sides of her head could have made it more so. When had she begun wearing her hair loose? No matter. Inside Cairhien, only a handful of people could order Moiraine Domodred. Most obeyed her commands. She had no doubt she could maintain whatever serenity was necessary, not now. The door at the end of the hallway opened onto a large, circular courtyard surrounded by tall brick arches supporting a columned walk. Gilded spires and domes suggested a palace, yet there was no one in sight. All lay silent and still beneath a clear spring sky. Spring, or a cool summer day, perhaps. She could not even remember what time of year it was. But she remembered who she was, the Lady Moiraine, who had been raised in the Sun Palace, and that was sufficient. She paused only long enough to locate the 6-pointed star made of polished brass set into the paving stones in the center of the courtyard, and, gathering her skirts, stepped outside. She moved as one born in a palace, head high, unhurrying. At her second step, the dress vanished, leaving her in her shift. That was impossible. By force of will, she continued her regal walk, serene, confident. Two more steps and her shift melted away. By the time silk stockings and lace garters went halfway to the shiny brass star, they seemed a grievous loss. That made no sense, but at least they had been some covering. A steady pace, serene and confident. Three men strolled out from one of the brick arches, bulky, unshaven fellows in rough-woven coats, the sort who wasted their days drinking in taverns or the common rooms of inns. Certainly not men who would be allowed to wander inside a palace. Color touched her cheeks, even before they noticed her and began leering. Ogling her! Anger flashed in her, and she suppressed it. Serenity. A steady movement, neither hurrying nor hanging back. It had to be so. She did not know why, only that it must be. One of the men raked his fingers through his greasy hair as though to straighten it, making a greater mess in the process. Another straightened his ragged coat. They began sauntering toward her, oily smirks twisting their faces. She had no fear of them, just the burning consciousness that these ruffians were seeing her without a stitch, without a single stitch. Yet she dared not channel until she reached the star. Utter calm and a steady pace. Deep buried anger twitched and strained, but she held it down. Her foot touched the brass star and she wanted to gasp with relief. Instead, she turned to face the three louts, and embracing Sidar, channeled air in the required weave. A solid wall of air, three paces high, flashed into being around them, and she tied it off. That was allowed. It rang with the sound of steel when one of them struck it. There was a six-pointed star gleaming in the brickwork at the top of the very arch the men had come out of. She was certain it had not been there earlier, yet it certainly was now. Walking at a steady pace became difficult, passing the wall of air, and she was glad she still held the power. By the curses and shouts she could hear from inside it, the men were attempting to climb out by scrambling atop one another's shoulders. Again, she was not afraid of them. Just of them seeing her naked again. Color stained her cheeks once more. It was very hard not to pick up her step. But she concentrated on that, on keeping her face smooth and unruffled, however red. Stepping through the arch, she turned, ready in case they... Light! Where was she? And why was she... unclothed? Why was she holding Sidar? She released it uneasily as well as reluctantly. She knew she had completed the first weave of 100 she must make out there in that empty courtyard. She knew that much, and no more, except that she must go on. Luckily, a set of garments lay on the floor just inside the arch. They were rough wool and thick, the stockings scratchy, yet they fit as though made for her, even the heavy leather shoes. Ugly things, but she put them on. It was very strange, given that what had seemed a palace courtyard lay behind her, but the doorless corridor she walked along was rough-dressed stone, lit by lamps set in iron brackets high on the walls, more suited to a fortress than a palace. It was not entirely doorless, of course. It could not be. She had to go on, and that meant she had to go somewhere. Even odder than the corridor was what the lone doorway at the far end revealed. A tiny village lay before her, a dozen small thatch-roofed houses and ramshackle barns, apparently abandoned in a dire drought. Warped doors creaked on their hinges as the wind blew dust along the single dirt street beneath a pitiless noonday sun. The heat struck her like a hammer, drenching her in sweat before she had gone 10 paces. She was suddenly glad for the stout shoes. The ground was rocky and might well have burned her in slippers. One stone well stood in the middle of what might once have been called the village green, a patch of dry dirt with scattered tufts of desiccated grass. On the cracked green tiles that made a rim around the well, where once men and women had stood to draw water, someone had painted a six-pointed star in red paint, now faded pale and chipped. As soon as she stepped onto that star, she began to channel. Air and fire, then earth. As far as she could see lay parched fields and twisted bare-branched trees. Nothing moved in that landscape. How had she come here? However it had happened, she wanted to be away from this dead place. Suddenly she was ensnared in black claw bushes, the dark inch-long thorns driving through her woolens, pricking her cheeks, her scalp. She did not bother with thinking it was impossible. She just wanted out. Every piercing burned, and she could feel blood trickling from some. Calm. She must display complete calm. Unable to move her head, she tried to feel for a way to pull at least a few of the tangled brown branches away, and very nearly gasped as sharp points dug into her flesh. Fresh blood dribbled down her arms. Calm. She could channel other weaves than what was required, but how to get rid of these cursed thorns? Fire was useless. The bushes looked dry as tinder, and burning them would envelop her in flames, too. She continued weaving while she thought, of course. Spirit, then air. Spirit followed by earth and air together. Air, then spirit and water. Something moved on one of the branches. A small, dark shape on eight legs. A memory drifted up from somewhere, and her breath caught in spite of herself. Keeping her face smooth strained her abilities to the utmost. The death's head spider came from the Aiel waste. How did she know that? Its name came from more than the gray marking on its back that resembled a human skull. One bite could sicken a strong man for days. Two could kill him. Still weaving the useless snarl of the five powers, why would she want to weave such a thing? But she must. Still weaving, she swiftly divided the flows and touched the spider with a tiny but very intricate weave of fire. The thing flashed to ash so quickly it did not so much as scorch the branch. It would not take much to set the bushes alight. Before she could feel relief, however, she spotted another spider crawling toward her, and killed it with that small weave, and then another and another. Light! How many were there? Her eyes, the only part of her that could move, searched hurriedly, and almost everywhere they lit she found another death's head crawling toward her. Every one she saw she killed, but so many where her eyes could find them begged the question, how many were below her sight? Or behind her? Calm! Burning spiders as rapidly as she could locate them, she began to weave faster at that great useless lump. In several places, thin tendrils of smoke rose from blackened spots on the branches. Holding her face in a smooth, frozen mask, she wove faster and faster. Dozens more spiders died, and more tendrils of smoke rose, some thicker. Once the first flame showed, it would spread like the wind. Faster! Faster! The last threads fell into place in the worthless weave, and as soon as she stopped weaving, the black claw bushes vanished. They were simply gone. The thorn pricks were not, but they hardly concerned her right then. She very much wanted to scramble out of her clothes and shake them out thoroughly, using flows of air. The spiders on the bushes had disappeared with the bushes, but what about any that might have crawled onto her dress? Or inside it? Instead, she searched for another six-pointed star and found it carved above the door of one of the thatch-roofed houses. Once inside, she could search her clothing. Calmly. She stepped through into pitch blackness. And found herself wondering where she was, and how she had gotten there. Why was she dressed in a farmer's woolens? And why was she bleeding as though she had rolled in a thorn bush? She knew that she had completed 2 of the 100 weaves she must make, and nothing more. Not even where the first had been made. Nothing except that the way she must go lay through this house. She did not look back at the bleak landscape behind her. All she could see ahead was a faint patch of light across the room. Strange. She was sure the windows had been unshuttered. Perhaps that glow indicated some way out, a crack beside a door, perhaps. She could have made a light, but she must not embrace the power again yet. Darkness held no fears for her, but she walked carefully to avoid bumping into anything. Nothing impeded her, though. For nearly a quarter of an hour she walked, with the patch of light slowly growing larger, before realizing that what she saw was a doorway. A quarter of an hour? In a house she could have walked around twice in a quarter of that. A very peculiar place, this. A dream, she would have thought, had she not known it was not. It took almost as long again to reach the doorway, which opened onto a scene as strange as that long walk. A solid wall of massive stones, 5 paces high and 30 on a side, surrounded a stone-paved square, but she saw nothing beyond it, not one building, not a tree. Nor were there any gates or doors. The one she had come out of was gone when she glanced back. A very casual glance, with her face holding its mask of calm as though it were carved. The air was moist and spring-like, the sky bright and clear, save for a few drifting white clouds, yet that failed to dent the ominous feel of the place. The 6-pointed star, a span across, was carved into the center of the square, and she walked toward it as close to quickly as she dared. Just before she reached it, a massive form in spiked mail pulled itself up on the wall and dropped down inside. It was as tall as an ogier, but no amount of squinting could make it seem human, though the body was human in form. A wolf's jaws and twitching ears made a horror of a face otherwise that of a man. She had seen drawings of Trollocs, but never before one in the flesh. Shadow spawn, born of the war that ended the Age of Legends. Servants of the Dark One, Trollocs inhabited the shadow-corrupted Blight along the borderlands. Could she be in the Blight? Her blood chilled at the thought. Behind her she heard the thud of boots landing heavily, and of hooves. Not all Trollocs had human feet. The wolf-muzzled creature drew a huge, scythe-curved sword that had been hanging on its back and began to run at her. Light, the thing was fast. She heard more running feet, running hooves. More Trollocs dropped over the wall ahead of her, faces marred with eagles' beaks and boars' tusked snouts. One more step and she was on the star. Straight away she embraced Sidar and began to weave, the required weave first, but as soon as the first strands of air, earth, and spirit were laid down, she divided her flows, making a second weave and a third of fire. There were a number of ways to produce balls of fire, and she chose the simplest. Throwing with both hands, she hurled them at the nearest Trollocs and spun, still weaving fire. She had to pause in the more important weave, but so long as she was quick enough. Light! There were a dozen Trollocs in the square with her, and more climbing over the walls. With both hands, she threw, as fast as she could weave, aiming for those closest, and where her fireballs struck, they exploded, decapitating a creature with a ram's snout and horns, blowing a goat-horned Trolloc in two, ripping off legs. She felt no pity. Trollocs took human prisoners only for food. Completing her spin, she was just in time to catch the major weave on the point of collapse, just in time to hurl balls of fire that removed an eagle-beaked head only paces away, and half the torso of a wolf-muzzled Trolloc that staggered across the edge of the star, before toppling in a lifeless sprawl. It was not going to work.